Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello, my name's David Runciman, and this is Past, Present, Future. Today, in our series about the ideas behind American elections, we've reached 1936. It's the first election in the ones I've been discussing with the historian Gary Gerstel, in which a president wins re-election, and also the first in which it's won by a landslide. Despite that, this election was a contest of really big ideas. Not just the New Deal, but the role of the Supreme Court, the nature of economic freedom, and above all, the future of American democracy. The election that is the subject of today's episode is a bit different from the ones that we've talked about so far. First of all, this one is a re-election. Franklin Roosevelt re-elected in 1936. Having first won in 32. It's also a landslide. He won overwhelmingly. The vote share in this case was over 60%, and his opponent, Alf Landon, the Republican, only got 36.5% of the popular vote. And in the Electoral College, the Republicans got 8. Roosevelt got 523. So there are not many what-ifs here. This is not an election where there's the thought that the actual outcome could have gone another way. We've chosen it to talk about because it is absolutely crucial in the history of American politics, American society, and indeed American political economy. And all presidential elections are interesting in different ways, and this is certainly one of them. Gary, one of the questions it seems to me that's most fascinating about Roosevelt is that he is known, of course, for the New Deal, and various terms are associated with his presidency, one of which is the first 100 days. That was the first 100 days in 1933, after he'd been elected, where a whole raft of measures at the absolute depths of the Great Depression, a country in various forms of despair, galvanized by this extraordinary agenda that he came into office with, but he wasn't elected on. So the platform that he won on in 32 was not a New Deal platform. It was actually quite conservative. Among other things, Roosevelt, when he was campaigning in 32, didn't talk about it much, but when pressed, presented himself as a balanced budget candidate. Sound public finances, not deficit financing, not taking emergency measures for emergency times, but getting the ship of state back on the rails. In 36, he is running as the New Deal candidate. It's get the job done campaign. Many campaigns are continuity versus change. He's the continuity candidate, having changed an awful lot in those 4 years. How would you characterize the biggest difference between Roosevelt the candidate in 36 and Roosevelt the candidate in 32?
Roosevelt in 32 is, as you described him, he's presenting a moderate face to the electorate. He wants to balance the budget. He does enunciate in that campaign that he is going to give the American people a New Deal, but he leaves the contents of that New Deal frustratingly vague. He's using the weapons that favored candidates often use if they think they're going to win. And Herbert Hoover had been entirely discredited by the Great Depression, the worst depression in all of American history. Don't say what you're going to do. Just preserve freedom of action. So there's not much he has to say.
And I should add, he didn't even say anything during the long period between winning the election and assuming office. So it was 5 months back then, and the American economy was still going down the plug hole. And Hoover, who had lost at that point, was desperate for Roosevelt to do some things with him, some bipartisan measures, something to signal to the American people that they were in it together. And Roosevelt refused to show his hand until day one.
It made Hoover furious and bred in him an enmity toward Roosevelt that would never die. When Roosevelt does come into office, he has the most stunning first 100 days legislatively of any president in American history. 15 major pieces of legislation passed. Enormous increase in executive power. To look at some of these pieces of legislation, some of them are major projects for reconstructing the economy, and the bill goes on for 4 or 5 pages, and Congress is asked to sign off on them without a lot of detail, and they agree to do so because the sense is the economy is in such a grave state that urgent executive action is needed immediately, and Congress is willing to go along. If we look more closely at the 15 pieces of legislation, they have different motivations, and it reflects the fact that Roosevelt had not yet settled fully on one program of political economy. Some bills were directed at elite groups and interests in American society. He wanted to put the banks back on their feet. He wanted to cartelize American industry, which is a way of saying he was encouraging oligopoly, encouraging them to get together, restrain production, coordinate with each other. It made a lot of sense, but it was also increasing elite power.
Very different from what his cousin had been advocating 20 years plus before.
The opposite of a trust buster. And on the other hand, he has ambitious programs, the Tennessee Valley Authority, a massive national program to bring hydroelectric power, agricultural development to one of the poorest areas in America, all of it state-funded and state-administered. He has a major program to transform American agriculture and bring prosperity back to American farmers. He has a major relief program for the unemployed. So there are different elements of this, but it lacks coherence. And the programs that seem to work or get the most publicity immediately are those favoring elite interests in American society. Put the banks together, and if we put the banks back together, the rest of the economy will follow. Get industry to work together. If we get industry to work together, the rest of the economy will follow. We might consider this a supply side version of political economy. And by that, I mean, work on the suppliers, get their enterprises in order. And if they are on a better keel, then the rest of the economy will recover. This works for a time. And also the motion, the energy, the declaration by Roosevelt that we have nothing to fear but fear itself brings hope to the American people after 4 years of a terrible depression and makes people feel that there will be a way for America to climb out of the worst depression in its history. So he gets a lot of popular support. The economic measures seem to be working for a time, but because the economic measures, certain crucial measures, depend so heavily on the voluntary willingness of industrialists to work with each other, as long as there seems to be an economic recovery underway, they're willing to do that. But as soon as the economic indicators point down again by 1934, they say, we've had enough of this. We're going to go our own way. We have to preserve our own enterprises. So they begin to abandon the New Deal, and that has the effect of angering ordinary Americans, farmers, workers, who, after being quiescent for the first few years of the New Deal, suddenly engage in protests that quickly become very major. And this is especially true for the labor movement. They have been given a little clause in a major piece of industrial legislation. This was a National Industrial Recovery Act, mostly oriented to help big corporations get back on their feet. But there's a little clause, 7A, that says workers have a right to join the unions and employers have an obligation to bargain with them collectively. There are no teeth in this little 7A. There's no enforcement mechanism. Workers take it seriously. The head of the United Mine Workers, John L. Lewis, says the president wants you to join a union. He was actually talking about himself, the president of the United Mine Workers. But he just says the president, meaning Franklin Roosevelt, wants you to join a union. This has an enormous stimulating effect on workers. They're joining unions in vast numbers. Employers won't bargain with them in any meaningful sense. And then the pattern of industrial relations that had so characterized American history for the previous 50 years, the resort to violence and confrontation, begins to reassert itself. And America by 1934 and 35 is on the cusp of an earthquake, some political earthquake of very great magnitude that could eventuate in a revolution. And Roosevelt begins to believe at this moment that he has to align his New Deal much more closely with the poor, with the working class, with ordinary Americans. And that structures what many historians call the Second New Deal. It wasn't called the Second New Deal at the time, but a set of pieces of legislation much more oriented toward ordinary working people, helping them, a version of Bryan's, you start from the bottom and you work prosperity through to the top rather than from the top down. And here are some of the signature features of the New Deal that will endure. Social Security, a program of pensions for the elderly, National Labor Relations Act, leveling the field between employers and unions, obligating employers with federal enforcement to bargain with them collectively. A very progressive wealth tax act, 75% on the highest wage earners in the United States. A massive jobs program, Works Progress Administration. 5 million jobs created directly by the federal government. You are then employed by the federal government. It's a decisive turn to the left of the political spectrum, and it firmly puts the New Deal on the side of the poor, the working class, and to a certain extent, the middling orders of American society. And this turn on Roosevelt's part is what excites the voting public and leads to his landslide victory in 1936. If he had not turned in this direction, I think the results of 1936 would have been quite different. So he is reading the political situation clearly, intelligently, strategically, and he makes the right call. Not because he suddenly himself has become a socialist or a social democrat, even though the programs he's encouraging bring America a version of social democracy. He feels he has to turn in this direction in order to survive politically.
As he said last time, thereby he bridged the gap that had opened up and seemed insuperable for the Democratic Party between that rural, agrarian, southern tradition and working men and now women in the cities in the north. He wins everywhere. Not quite everywhere, but almost everywhere. He wins in the South, he wins in the North, he wins in the Midwest, he wins in the West. For the first time in its history, the Democratic Party, which after all is the party not just of the South, but the Confederate South, in a sense, wins a significant number of black voters to its side. So this is just the beginnings of what is going to be the extraordinary, dramatic, upside-down flip of American politics, so that over the course of the 20th century, the electoral map looks the same, but with all the colors reversed. Blue states become red states become blue states. But it's just the beginning of that, because he is still strongest in the South, and the South is still Jim Crow, Dixie South. He still needs the support of Southern legislators to get his program through Congress. There was a real question in 1932, 1933, not whether the United States would collapse into revolution, that's always possible, but whether it would collapse into dictatorship. Was it going to be possible for an elected president to overcome this depression without resorting to some measures that in Europe had taken hold? People had seen Mussolini, they'd seen the beginnings of the Hitler era. And there was a thought that America, this is the direction of travel in the world. Stalin with his five-year plans, the world is heading to dictatorship. Democracy's had its time. And Roosevelt was determined not to be a dictator, but that meant he had to get this stuff through Congress. He couldn't do it by executive action. Congress meant winning the votes of the South. So given that, there's a new divide here in a way, you might say. Here's a party that is starting to pick up black votes, particularly in the North. In the South, black voters weren't allowed to vote. It could be shifting to becoming a different kind of party. And yet, here's a president who, if he's not going to be a dictator, needs the representatives of the racist South that was denying black voters the vote to vote for him in Congress. So maybe we've conquered the rural agrarian divide, but we've got a new race divide opening up in this party.
Yes, absolutely. The Republican Party was the party of Lincoln. It was a party of emancipation. It was the party that ended slavery. It was the party of African Americans.
Within, for a few people, living memory.
Yes, there are still African Americans alive in the 30s who had been enslaved as children in the American South. And it's also interesting to note that one of the public works programs of the New Deal records interviews with many of these people, which are available for listening courtesy of the Library of Congress, and has become an incredibly important source for reconstructing the life of the enslaved before the Civil War, made possible by the New Deal. That's an aside. In 1932, the results of the election still indicate very strong black support for the Republican Party, and that changes significantly between 1932 and 36. And the way in which some people described it, turning the portrait of Lincoln to the wall. In many black homes, there was a portrait of Lincoln hanging up. Before you could vote for Roosevelt, you had to pay your respects to Lincoln. And so don't vote for Roosevelt when he's looking at you. Turn the picture around. What makes this so interesting is that Roosevelt was not going to act on civil rights legislation. He was not going to end Jim Crow, America's system of apartheid. He was not going to enact a federal anti-lynching law, something that African Americans desperately wanted, because lynching was a form of terror deployed with regularity, still the era of the Klan in the South. Roosevelt is not going to do that, not because he's not sympathetic to these concerns, and his wife, Eleanor Roosevelt, is a tremendous supporter of racial equality in the United States. But he says, if I'm going to have any chance of getting my legislative package through, I need the support of white senators and congressmen. Because the Democratic Party was the only functioning party in the South, there was no serious opposition, and that meant that senators and congressmen from the South, once elected, tended to get reelected and reelected and reelected, and Congress worked on a seniority system. And so the heads of most of the major committees in the Senate and the House were in the hands of white Southerners. Now, they had progressive elements to their politics. They are, in some respects, the heirs of the populists, William Jennings Bryan, Andrew Jackson. They are willing to go along with Roosevelt's ambitious projects for reconstructing political economy with one proviso, that Roosevelt will do nothing to interfere with the racial hierarchies of the South. He will not lift a finger to interfere with Jim Crow. He's been deeply criticized for this position, but it's also the case that if he had become a strong advocate for racial equality, much of the New Deal would have been doomed. The historian Ira Katz Nelson has talked about this Southern white power forming an iron cage that encased the New Deal. So while the New Deal was very progressive in so many ways, it did markedly little to ameliorate the conditions of African Americans in the South. So the question is, why are African Americans turning to the party of Jackson and Jefferson? Why are they turning to the Jackson-Jefferson dinners every year during the New Deal? This is the high moment of the Democratic Party. Why are they turning to the party of the enslavers? They are doing so through a set of economic calculations. They believe in the New Deal programs. They believe, especially in 1934 and 35, that the programs being put in place will benefit blacks economically, that the opportunity to join unions, the opportunity to get certain benefits will benefit them economically, so that even though they're not getting racial justice, they are increasing their economic opportunity. So this marks the beginning of Democratic Party's ability to convince not just white Americans, but Americans of multiple races, that it is the party of the people. It is, in incipient form, the origins of the modern Democratic Party, which defines itself not just in terms of economic opportunity for the poor and the middling orders, but as an institution that pushes forward the rights for all Americans, regardless of race. This is the moment when that new Democratic Party begins to be formed, but it's important to recognize that it only exists in an incipient form. It is not yet a force to be reckoned with.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
One feature of this election, and I'm not sure if this is a general rule, it may not be a rule at all, but there are certain elections, presidential elections, where the result is a foregone conclusion. And I think this was one. There was no way that the Republican candidate was going to win this election past a certain point. You can always hope, right? But, and there have been others, for instance, later on Lyndon Johnson against Barry Goldwater in 1964. When elections are really close, it constrains the candidates in what they can say, and it constrains the platforms. People become very, very risk averse in close elections because you lose 10,000 votes in Michigan, you might lose the country. So don't say anything that might frighten people. When the election is not close, it frees candidates, parties, platforms up to be a bit more ambitious in articulating a vision. It was true of Goldwater, I think, in 64, and indeed Lyndon Johnson. And in a way, it's true of this election too. One distinctive feature of this election is that it was quite philosophical in the sense that an argument was joined between the two sides, which was not true in 32, about the nature of freedom. Roosevelt articulated it, and the Republicans tried to articulate it too. So they tried to explicitly come up with an argument against the New Deal couched in the language of economic freedom, that is, freedom of the market from state control, with an awareness that some of the things that Roosevelt was doing, economic planning, could be couched as one or two steps away from what Stalin was doing, economic planning, and that it's a slippery slope. And the slippery slope arguments were going to become all the vogue for those on the libertarian edge of politics. The economist Friedrich Hayek was going to become the champion of this way of thinking. Landon started to talk about what was wrong with the New Deal by saying, I quote, "The price of economic planning is economic freedom." So these two things oppose each other. The more the government does to control the economy, industry, the labor market, free bargaining, all of those things we talked about last time that the Supreme Court was defending and most of the political spectrum was starting to oppose, Republicans were coming back to that position. We are going to stand up for individual freedom against different kinds of collectivism, which helps push Roosevelt to articulate the counterview, which is you cannot simply define economic freedom in terms of the absence of government constraint or government interference. Economic freedom means something more than that. And it starts to sound like an argument between what were later, thanks to the philosopher Isaiah Berlin, to come to be known as the proponents of negative liberty, that would be the Republican position here, and positive liberty, which is something more than the absence of constraint. Positive liberty means the capacity to do things, not the absence of things preventing you, but a positive capacity. And Roosevelt, doesn't he start to articulate that? It's completely different from 32 in that respect.
He does. And dare I say, he anticipates Isaiah Berlin. And here are some words from Roosevelt from his acceptance of the nomination in 1936. "That very word freedom in itself and of necessity suggests freedom from some restraining power. This is freedom in its traditional sense. This is liberalism in its classical sense. You free the individual from constraining forces in their lives. And this idea of liberalism is deeply embedded in the American revolutionary moment of the 18th century and deeply embedded as well in the Constitution of the United States." Later in the same speech, Roosevelt feels compelled to offer a different definition of freedom. He says, "An old English judge once said, 'Necessitous men are not free men. Liberty requires opportunity to make a living decent according to the standard of the time, a living which gives man not only enough to live by, but something to live for. These are my words now. Who is going to give that necessitous man something to live for? It's going to be the government. The government is going to lift men and women out of circumstances of necessity and give them something to live for, provide them with education, provide them with a minimum wage, provide them with an old age pension, provide them with power at the workplace so they can improve the circumstances of their labor. Government is required in Roosevelt's telling to enable men and women to be free. This is an articulation of the concept of positive liberty. You cannot be free. You cannot have liberty unless certain requirements of life have been secured. And this becomes the philosophical foundation for the New Deal. And it enables Roosevelt to execute what I consider to be one of the great terminological heists in political history in the modern era. And that is, he takes the word liberalism, which had been defined in classical terms as freedom from overbearing government, and he imbues liberalism with his message of positive liberty. The United States will not have liberalism unless it has a strong government that positions people to be free. And that becomes what liberalism in America is.
To the confusion of Europeans, who often are baffled by the idea that liberal means, for want of a better phrase, left wing.
Understandable bafflement of Europeans. What Roosevelt has engaged in is what in Europe would be called a form of social democracy. It's not as fully developed in America as in Europe, but it's following similar principles. And liberalism in America becomes a kind of synonym for social democracy. It's putting people in a position to enjoy and make the most of their freedom. And for that, a strong federal state looking after both the individual and common good becomes absolutely essential. And that is what is at the heart of the New Deal.
I want to give you one counterfactual here. This was not an election where third parties played a major role, and those populist currents that we've been talking about, most of them were swept up by Roosevelt and what he did. And there was a streak of populism too, a form of populism in some of the opposition to the New Deal, particularly when it was anchored in various kinds of racist ideas. And there was a lot of conspiracy theorizing going on here on the right as well as the left. This is the era of mass communication through radio. Roosevelt mastered it, but so did Father Coughlin, the conspiracy theory monger. Suspicion of government, of the New Deal, of the kind of people who were putting this together, including, among others, Jews, was still rife in America. So it's not like populism has gone away or Roosevelt has neutralized it. But there was a significant figure in American politics who might have played a role in this election if he hadn't been assassinated a year earlier. Huey Long from Louisiana, one of those fascinating, terrifying figures that American politics throws up from time to time. He was a populist, for sure. He was absolutely a man of the South. But he was contemplating a run for president, initially maybe a quixotic attempt to seize the Democratic nomination, but then use that as a platform to launch a third-party bid and to position himself against Roosevelt, I think, as a more explicitly racist candidate, but at the same time, a champion of the white poor, the Southern white poor. And he advocated some policies that went a lot further than Roosevelt. Part of his program was called the Share Our Wealth program, and it was just straightforwardly redistributive. One of its platforms was, we will just give everyone automatically, as long as they're white, a basic wage. It was universal basic income many, many decades before that became a fashionable idea again. I don't know whether Roosevelt saw Long as a threat. I think there was some anxiety in the Democratic Party about what this man could do. The counterfactual is, had he not been assassinated, could this have been different? So say there had been a third party headed by Huey Long running in the 36 election, coming out of Louisiana, based in the South, offering really populist messages, both on race and also on redistribution. Could it have undercut what Roosevelt was doing?
I don't think so. Although I will say the rival Roosevelt most feared was Huey Long, not Alf Landon or anyone in the Republican Party. He understood that there was populist and labor thunder on the left. I doubt whether Huey Long would have started a third party. He was so embedded in the Democratic Party. So I have trouble imagining him starting a third party, and it would have been very difficult, given Roosevelt's popularity, for him to successfully challenge Roosevelt for the nomination in 1936. The only thing that could have allowed that to happen is if Roosevelt had become dogmatic, if he had insisted that the policies of the early years of the New Deal were the ones that he was going to follow through with. Instead, he pivots to the left, and he's pivoting to the left so he can steal Huey Long's thunder, so he can steal the labor movement's thunder, so he can steal the left thunder. He clearly positions himself considerably further to the left in 1935 than he had ever been in his previous 20 years of public service. So it's his experimental nature, his flexibility, his shrewdness as a politician that allows him to pivot in this way and reclaim what in 1935 was the sweet spot in American politics. We can contrast him with Hoover in this regard, who stands out in the 30s for his inflexibility, for his dogmatism, for responding to this enormous economic crisis through certitude, through frigidity, unable to think improvisationally, falling back on dogma. Roosevelt was Hoover's opposite in that regard. He was flexible. He was experimental. He was often criticized for being a waffler, moving in different directions, not having core beliefs. I don't share that view of Roosevelt, but certainly flexibility, adaptability, a recognition of the unprecedented nature of this crisis, which required any skillful politician, and this was deeply in the thinking of Roosevelt, to be skillful at adaptation, moving in different ideological directions, so as to stay where the center of political gravity was. So I would say Huey Long quite dramatically shifted political gravity to the left on economic matters. Roosevelt grasped that and tried to occupy the space that Huey Long had found.
That contrast with Hoover, man who was president before Roosevelt, has always struck me as a good illustration of one of the illusions of democratic politics, which is the thought that if you could get someone from outside politics, someone who made their name in business, or in Hoover's case, both as an engineer, as a businessman, and also as an organizer. He organized relief after the First World War. He's a man of action, a pragmatist. You'll get someone in office who will have the flexibility, the pragmatism of a kind of man of the world, you know, someone who's seen stuff outside of politics. Those people often turn out to be the ones who are like rabbits frozen in the headlights when things go really badly wrong. What you want is an unscrupulous, devious professional politician, even one who has a clearly articulated platform. Those are the adaptable ones. And I think actually politics, including maybe American politics, is littered with stories of the outsider who's going to come in and work this thing out from an outside perspective being paralyzed in Washington. And it's the career politicians, it's the insiders. But it's also the people who look like they are politicians who will find it hard to move because they are party men who are the flexible ones. I think that is the definitive version of that contrast. The great presidents are the politicians.
I would agree, although the great politicians, I would also say, have their unscrupulousness tethered to some core beliefs somewhere. And I think Roosevelt had that tethering. Hoover's a really interesting figure in this regard because he was one of the most accomplished men ever to hold the presidency. Orphaned in Iowa, raised by foster parents, got into Stanford, became a mining engineer, headed up mining ventures all over the world for 10 or 15 years, organized mass exodus of Americans in London in 1914 when the war broke out, get them back to America, organize this extraordinary relief project to save the European masses from famine as a consequence of World War I. Full of ideas as Secretary of Commerce, imaginative in various ways as president, 1928 to 1932. What he had never encountered was a crisis of the magnitude of the Great Depression, and he became much more dogmatic as a result of that. Part of it is that the skills of private life are not automatically transferable to public life. But it's also the case that we don't know how individuals are going to react to an enormous crisis until the crisis hits. And the Hoover of the 1930s is almost unrecognizable relative to the Hoover of the 1920s or 19-teens. He becomes dogmatic. He can't think creatively. He's just furious at Roosevelt for his apparent lack of principles. Thinks he's put America on the road to dictatorship. He becomes one of the most reviled figures in American life in the 1930s. And unlike other presidents who were very unpopular during their term in office and are later able to escape a certain ignominy, George W. Bush is one of them, Hoover never escapes. That's what he's known for. Cold-hearted man, unequal to the task that America put in front of him.
After Roosevelt had won in 36, there's another irony here, which is this is the election that he ran on an explicit New Deal platform. Vote for me and this is what you'll get, more of this. Unlike in 1932, where he had run on a much more cautious, hedged platform, but then all guns blazing as soon as he was in office. From his re-election and from 1937 onwards, though he has this massive landslide for this program, it becomes much harder for him to get anything done. And this is partly because he has moved by this point to the left. Some conservative Democrats in his own party in Congress began to make alliance with Republicans to block what they saw as the more extreme versions of what the New Deal came to entail. So legislatively, it became harder and harder to get this done. The big barrier in the way of this kind of political program, the Supreme Court, remained there. He had, in his frustration, suggested that what he wanted to do was reform. That means, in the language of the time, pack the Supreme Court with sympathetic justices, because there was no way round it, over it, under it. And he failed in that. That turned out to be, I think, in the view of most historians, a political step too far. The second term for Roosevelt was much more frustrating than the first term. And historians, I think, disagree about this, the extent to which actually there was some hubris involved here. Some of this was Roosevelt's own fault, including the Supreme Court packing plan. And there was relative failure compared to what he achieved, particularly 34, 35. Do you think there's hubris here? Let's take the Supreme Court packing example. Did he overreach?
No, I don't think he overreached. The two major reforms of 1935, the National Labor Relations Act, giving labor power, backing it up with federal authority, the Social Security Act, giving pensions to elderly Americans, were not clearly constitutional according to the way in which the Constitution was being interpreted. And he faced the very real possibility that the Supreme Court was going to declare both measures unconstitutional. And things are coming to a head in 1937. So in the first year of his second term. And this is when he announces the court packing plan for every justice 70 or above. They obviously can't handle the workload, so I'm going to appoint another justice for every person on the court who's 70 or more. And that was quite a lot of justices at that point. That does enrage the public, or significant parts of the public, but it's not the end of the story. The United Auto Workers, one of the most powerful and progressive American unions, occupies several plants of General Motors, the most powerful corporation in the world at that point in time, for 6 weeks. Workers are occupying the factories, preventing production. Historically, when that had happened in the past, either the governor of the state in question, in this case Michigan, or the president of the United States had sent in troops to evict the strikers, break the strikes, protect corporate property. Roosevelt refuses to send in the troops. Governor Murphy of Michigan refuses to send in the troops. And that inclines General Motors to think we no longer have the backing of the federal government. Perhaps we do, in fact, need to compromise with our workers and grant them certain rights that they have been promised and guaranteed by the National Labor Relations Act. This is going on just as the Supreme Court is deciding the constitutionality of the Wagner Act and of Social Security. Both those decisions come in March 1937. At the last moment, one justice who had been opposed to sanctioning the constitutionality of those two acts switches his vote, giving Roosevelt a 5-4 majority, declaring these two critical pieces of legislation constitutional. If we imagine no sit-down strike in General Motors for 6 weeks, and the country being on edge, and facing the possibility of extreme action if these core principles or programs of the New Deal were not endorsed by the Supreme Court, this is a fraught time in America. This is another near-revolutionary moment. The justices have this matter on their minds, and this was a moment, I think, for Roosevelt to be aggressive with the court and to put additional pressure on them, additional pressure being that he was going to pack the Supreme Court with additional justices if they didn't come through on these crucial matters. And I think the combination of the militancy of the labor movement and the threat from Roosevelt gets at least one justice to change his mind. Owen Roberts was the justice who changed his mind. They only needed one 5-4 decision. The New Deal is declared constitutional in March 1937. It is true that because of the furor about Roosevelt's court packing plan, that it made it much more difficult for him to get any other program through Congress from 1937 to 1940. So in that very real sense, it stalled the New Deal. On the other hand, he got crucial constitutional sanction for two of his most important reforms. And more importantly, it seemed to break the will of what had been a conservative court that had constantly opposed progressive movements in the populist era, a progressive era, and the New Deal. Roosevelt has 8 appointments to the court between 1937 and 1943, and he literally is able to remake the court in a progressive direction. This is going to become the foundation for the famous Warren Court, liberal court of the 1960s. And that court is deeply, deeply committed to authorizing the central state to enact a program of positive liberty in the United States. So even though Roosevelt is stymied in the short term, he succeeds in institutionalizing his New Deal program for decades. So in that way, I would say the confrontation that occurs in 36 and 37, in the long term, breaks in his favor.
Finally, as you said, legislatively, between 1937 and 1940, he was blocked, not entirely, but it was much harder to get legislation through Congress. Of course, what changes in 1940 is not only re-election. By 1940, the world is at war again. And before long, in Roosevelt's third term, the United States will be at war. And this will be a war of a kind that America has never fought before. So in the First World War, America was a participant, a late participant. It required a national effort. An army more or less had to be created and shipped overseas. Liberty bonds had to be sold. Government financing changed. Did a lot to change the country. Nothing on the scale of the Second World War, which was a total war and required government action to an extent that would have been unimaginable in any version of the New Deal. Government spending, government deficit financing, levels of taxation, control of the economy, of the labor market, of pricing, everything. And not just in the United States. All of the competence, the major competence in the Second World War. Britain under Churchill was nonetheless not that different from a country that might have been under a socialist prime minister. The New Deal goes through 3 phases, one might say. The first term, from almost nothing, something remarkable happened. The second term, frustration, counterintuitive outcomes of what might or might not have been overreach. And then the war phase, where it becomes something that would have been unimaginable a decade before. This isn't really a counterfactual, because I don't think there's a version of history where you say, what if the Second World War hadn't happened? But it is ultimately war, and it's often true in the history of democracies, it is war with all of its consequences that allows for a transformation of the relationship between government and the citizenry. And in this case, it was the war that created the foundations of what came in the late 40s, in the 50s, in the 60s, through to the 70s, when something else happened. It's New Deal plus war that gives you the legacy of Roosevelt's presidency, isn't it? You can't do it without war.
Mostly agree with you. I would put it a little differently. I don't think war creates the foundation for the post-war political economy in the United States, but it does secure the foundations of that economy, which had been laid in the 1930s. If Roosevelt's actions in 36 and 37 saved the New Deal constitutionally, the war, one could argue, saves the New Deal in political economic terms. It has to be pointed out that the New Deal did not affect robust economic recovery in the 1930s. There are moments of recovery that proved to be temporary, 1934, 1936, 37. Part of the problem that Roosevelt was facing is his unwillingness to embrace Keynesian economics fully. His second New Deal of 35, 36 is a form of vernacular Keynesianism. When the economy is depressed, you spend money. This is counterintuitive and very hard for rulers at this time to understand, because you're operating on the principle of a household. If you lose your job, if things are bad, you tighten your belt. And Keynes is arguing something profoundly counterintuitive. No, you loosen your belt. This is the moment for government to spend, to inject money into the economy, to stimulate demand, to put the economy on the road to recovery, and then you tighten your belt during periods of prosperity. Roosevelt and his New Dealers are doing this in 36. I don't think they have read Keynes at this point, but that's why I'm calling it Keynes in the vernacular. But they're nervous about this. They're not comfortable. And as soon as the economy begins to show recovery, they tighten too soon and they plunge America into depression again. And what frees them from that intuitive way of thinking are the imperatives of total war. And so what war brings to America is the full-fledged implementation of Keynesian principles.
And a level of debt that, frankly, would have been unimaginable in peacetime.
Would have been unimaginable. And that opens up a new way of thinking economically and frees Democratic policymakers from the constraints that they have been operating under during the 30s. So the 30s are a transitional time. Without the war and what the imperatives of war had demanded, the Keynesian principles may never have been fully implemented in the United States. So in that sense, the war is absolutely crucial to the long-term survival of the New Deal. It saves the political economy of the New Deal by realizing the full instruments of governing the economy that the New Deal had hit upon in the 1930s, but for a variety of reasons, implemented only unevenly.
Roosevelt never became a dictator, but in the end, it was the other dictators that liberated his form of politics to its full potential.
Yes.
If you'd like to sign up to our new, free, fortnightly newsletter, just click on the link that you'll find in the show description for this episode. Our current issue is about American elections. We'll also be telling you soon how you can get a bonus episode in this series about the amazing, mind-blowing election of 1968. Meanwhile, our next episode on Thursday is about the election of 1980 that saw Ronald Reagan arrive in the White House. It seemed to signal the end of New Deal politics. So what did come next? This has been Past, Present, Future, brought to you in partnership with the London Review of Books.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.